Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Convicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff called lobbying legalized bribery. He's just out of jail flipping pizzas in Baltimore. In the Beltway, lobbyists are still very much in the game and on the money. Right now, BP is beefing up its arsenal of lobbyists. The car dealer lobby is poised to drive home a sweet deal. What's going on and what's really happening behind the scenes? This hour on Point, raising the curtain on lobbying. And you can join the conversation. What images first come to mind when you hear the word lobbyist? Can Washington do business without them? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Washington, D.C. is Paul Singer. He's associate editor and investigative reporter at Roll Call, and he's been following the lobbyist beat for a long time now. Paul, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Good. Fine. Thank you. Give us some perspective on lobbying in Washington, D.C. How much a part of the legislative process is it?
Well, it's a critical part of the legislative process. I mean, lobbying is born out of the First Amendment to the Constitution, which says, as everyone remembers, of course, the free speech and the freedom of religion. But it also says that the government shall not prohibit you from petitioning the government for a redress of grievances. That is lobbying. If I write a letter to my congressperson and I say, gee, I need you to help build a power plant in my town, that's an important thing for my town, that's lobbying. That's what our government is based on, that the people, the representatives of the people, answer to the people, and so the people should be able to tell them what we would like them to do.
And yet 40 years ago, lobbying was the work of a small group of lawyers. Today, it's a multi-billion dollar industry involving thousands of people, including many ex-senators, former House members from both parties. Who would you say benefits the most from this industry today?
Well, it's hard to say who benefits the most. I mean, what is clear is that we have gone from the point of, you know, Mrs. Jones writing a letter saying, gosh, I'd like a power plant in our town, to a lobbying industry. It is a multi-billion dollar business that is its expertise is in representing issues in front of Congress and getting things done that you or I may not be able to get done because we don't know the right people, we don't know the way, the procedures to pass the legislation, we don't know what levers to pull. It's like any other sort of consulting business, really, in that case. You're paid for your expertise, not necessarily your ability to swing a hammer.
So help us understand some of the big current issues, the big issues before Congress that have been heavily influenced by lobbying. Start with the NRA that got itself actually written out of a campaign finance bill.
Right. And this is sort of a classic Washington power play. There's a campaign finance bill. Without getting into, you know, meaningless detail, the long and the short of it is the Supreme Court has recently ruled, eliminated a whole bunch of limits on corporate spending in elections. The Congress is interested in restoring, if not the limits, at least some disclosure requirements for that campaign spending. So there's a bill that would essentially create a whole bunch of new reporting requirements if you're going to spend money in an election. And the National Rifle Association said, well, we don't like this. We don't want to be part of this. And we'll kill the bill. We'll vote against it. And we'll urge our supporters to vote against members of Congress who support this bill. That's a really powerful tool. The NRA has a terrific ability to mobilize grassroots people in opposition to or in favor to whatever bill they're pushing at the moment. So they said, well, we're going to have our people vote this bill down. We're going to vote you out of office if you pass it. That was pretty convincing. So instead, the Democrats sat down and negotiated a deal that essentially exempts from this bill the NRA. It's a provision that's written in such a way that if you are a giant organization that's been around a certain period of time, you're not covered. And the NRA agreed to say, okay, well, in that case, we'll stand on the sidelines. We won't support the bill, but we won't oppose it either. Mm. And that makes it possible to pass the rest of the legislation.
So that's one example. Another that's in the news right now, of course, is BP, who's right in the middle of hiring a bevy of high-priced Washington lobbyists to help them weather calls for policy changes in the middle of the Gulf oil crisis.
Right. And this is an example of where you'll see sort of crisis-driven representation. It can be everything from we need expert lobbyists who know something about energy legislation to prevent a provision that we don't want in the bill or to urge a provision we do want in the bill. They're also going to hire image consultants, frankly, who are going to do things like help them prepare for the next press release, help them prepare for the next hearing. What questions are you likely to get out of member X or Y or Z? Those representatives, those lobbyists, know member X, Y, and Z. They know what those issues are that they're concerned about. They can prepare their client, in this case BP, for the hostile questioning they may get or perhaps even for the friendly questioning they may get from other quarters.
One constituency that we may not have heard so much about but that is important are car dealers who right now Congress is on the verge of creating a Consumer Financial Protection Board and exempting car dealers from its scrutiny.
Right. And car dealers are a great example of the power of grassroots lobbying. It's been known for years because there's a car dealership in every district. There's probably several.
Right.
And they, 10,000 people in your congressional district are driving around with a car with your nameplate on the back of it. They are well-known, well-respected organizations. They fund a lot of, or they pay for a lot of economic activity in the district. They have tremendous credibility with members of Congress, and they can mobilize a lot of people. So if there's something that's going to affect, in this case, I believe that, and I don't know the financial industry bill all that well, but the gist of this one is these guys are also lenders, obviously. They're auto lenders. They want to be exempted from some regulations. Well, they can fly in car dealers from all over the country to meet with the members of Congress, and they say, hey, not only are we going to oppose this, but we're going to tell all our customers to oppose it. We're going to tell all the people who work for us to oppose it. That's a tremendous amount of power they can bring, even though each car dealership may be a pretty small organization.
So lobbyists,
they are very, very convincing.
Very convincing, very powerful. I'm actually hearing, Paul Singer, lobbyists actually writing legislation with congresspeople, actually putting their names on it. Is that true and is that typical?
Yes. And yes. And let me give you the best possible scenario on this. Let's say you wanted to regulate anything, UGG boots. You know, you want to ban UGG boots because you think they're ugly. Well, you'd still need to go to the industry and say, or to some lobbyist and say, or some expert and say, okay, well, we want to ban UGG boots, but not sandals and not sneakers and not all high-level boots and not all, shearling boots. How do we do it? Well, you talk to the industry, and the industry says, well, you'd have to ban it this way. You'd have to write the legislation this way. There's a lot of details you have to work out. You can't just put in a line that says, by the way, UGG boots are now illegal. Lobbyists frequently draft that language, hand it to the member of Congress and say, this is the way it would work. And then, of course, the member of Congress and their staff, really, go back and forth. Well, we can't do this section. We can't do that section. We almost never see this. Every now and then we get a copy of something that actually has the sort of paper trail on it. You can see where the lobbyist actually drafted the language, particularly when it's a letter to an agency about an issue. If a member of Congress has written a letter to, the Food and Drug Administration about a particular drug, I can almost guarantee you that the industry or the company involved had a hand in drafting the letter. It's embarrassing to the member of Congress when we find out, but it's not illegal.
Embarrassing. I mean, but how much blame lies with the lobbyists and how much goes to members of Congress? I mean, do they have so much on their plate that they don't actually have time to write this legislation? Or is it fair that they hire consultants or quote-unquote experts to do the work?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm a relatively smart guy, but I'm not going to repair my own sewer line. I'm going to hire somebody who's an expert in sewer lines. I mean, I know how to swing a hammer and I know how to dig a trench, but this is something that's important. I want to get it right. I'm going to hire somebody. To some degree, it makes sense for members of Congress to look for outside expertise for advice. Mm-hmm. I mean, I assume they have lawyers, too, who are doing some of their legal work. And they have staff who do some of this. But it's not necessarily wrong for a member of Congress to ask for outside expertise to help them make important decisions that are going to affect a major industry, right? Nothing about that is inherently wrong. Where you begin to get really interesting news stories is when there is exchange of cash dollar going back and forth between the lobbyist and the congressman's campaign, where they may be someone who used to work for the member of Congress, where the congresswoman's staff is also married to the lobbyist, perhaps. I mean, there's all kinds of really interesting conflicts of interest that can arise from this. But the premise is not necessarily corrupt.
And so how often is that going on, Paul Singer? How much of what's going on is actually illegal, you know, on the scale of Jack Abramoff, who says, you know, I was essentially participating in legalized bribery in Washington? How much of that is actually illegal and how much is just sort of on the line?
Well, the line is really, really broad. How much of it is illegal is, well, let me put it this way. Jack Abramoff, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with this case. You know, he was taking millions and millions of dollars from Indian tribes primarily, but other clients as well. He was involved in a lot of backroom deals with a lot of his pals. He was buying tickets and giving gifts to all of these congressional staff and members. Jack Abramoff went to jail. There have been a bunch of guilty pleas amongst congressional staff, but only one member of Congress did time in jail. So where is the illegality? Who is guilty? And who can be proven guilty and put in jail? I would argue that it is increasingly difficult to actually convict a member of Congress of any crime. The laws are all trending the other way. It is almost impossible to convict them unless you essentially find the letter saying, yes, I will take your bribe. Thank you very much. Short of that, it's almost impossible to prove any of it's illegal. It may be unethical. It may be embarrassing. It may make for really bad headlines. But it's impossible to, almost impossible to convict.
And with so much money flowing into the political system every day, that complicates it as well.
Right. I mean, a large part of why we have these conversations is because every member of Congress is going to have to raise $2 or $3 million over a 2-year period. They're only allowed to raise it by and large in small amounts from individual donors. And the easiest way to do that is to call your friend, for instance, a lobbyist from the auto dealership industry and say, get all your auto dealer friends to raise some money for me.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about lobbyists in Washington. I'm joined by Paul Singer, associate editor, investigative reporter at Roll Call. And I'd like now to welcome two other voices to the conversation. Tom Ferguson joins me in the studio. He's a political science professor at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He's author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Political Parties and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Tom, welcome to On Point.
Hi.
And Nick Allard joins us from Washington, D.C. He's head of Patton Boggs Lobbying and Political Practice Wing. Patton Boggs is Washington's largest lobbying firm. Nick, welcome to you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Jane.
Thank you. Tom, I'll begin with you. How do you view the state of lobbying in this country today in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I mean, look, I think trying to locate lobbying in the First Amendment is a nice touch. It reminds me of that story when Jay Gould, Jim Fisk, and Daniel Drew were fighting for control of a railway with Cornelius Vanderbilt. And when Vanderbilt bought all the stock, Gould, Fisk, and Drew started printing it. And then when they were hauled into court, they defended that as saying, well, that was freedom of the press. You know, I mean, look, you know, what's next? To defend BP because right to sort of pollute the Gulf of Mexico because normally we allow people to sort of run legitimate businesses? I don't think so. Look here, you're talking about a gigantic money-driven political system. That's what you got. Let me give you some we now know a lot more than I have to tell you than even the press typically reports. There's a lot of good. In the last few years, people have started to do some fairly good econometric research. I got a wonderful paper from three folks in Britain the other day. What they do is this, is they look at folks who left congressmen and women's offices and set up as lobbyists. Now, since they've set up as lobbyists, you can actually track their income because I got to report what they earn on in this stuff. And this paper is quite remarkable. What it shows you is that if you set up in business, if you work for a U.S. senator and that senator retires, this is after you've established yourself as a lobbyist, your income takes a 20% dive immediately and it stays down. Let's put it in, what they're showing you there is you're running a giant patronage network.
So it's the fabled
are just
revolving,
selling services.
Revolving
door.
Yes, the revolving door.
So, hey, Nicholas, let me let Nick Allard in here, because your article in the Stanford Law and Policy Review is titled "Lobbying is an Honorable Profession," in which you write that lobbying is more necessary, more widespread, and more complicated than ever before, and that good lobbying contributes to good government. From your perspective, based on what Tom Ferguson just said as well, make the case. How so?
Well, I think Paul Singer offered a real brilliant tour de force insight, and I, you know, wish I could be as articulate and accurate and balanced as he was in sort of explaining the mysteries of how Washington works. But, you know, practically everybody in the country has a lobbyist working for them in some capacity, whether a teacher, a policeman, or a kid, or a patient, or a doctor, or a big company, or a small company. You know, everybody has lobbyists, and, you know, nobody minds having a lobbyist work for their interest. What bugs people is when, and what bothers them is the other guy's lobbyist. So that's number one. Number two is, the fact is, this is not the conventional wisdom. And when I say this in schools, universities across the country, usually the audience is split 50-50 between groans and laughter. But money doesn't buy results. Now, this is probably right in the teeth of Tom Ferguson's hard work and analysis, but maybe there's not that much difference if you just bear me out. The fact is that our lawmakers, whether they're in agencies or in the Congress, have to do what makes public policy and political sense. And nobody's going to be around very long if they're just doing something for a political reason or a campaign contribution reason. And there has to be a public policy justification. Now, that process, that arena, is incredibly complicated. Now, the only thing I took issue with Paul Singer is when he sort of compared lobbyists to maybe being sewer experts. I would have preferred rocket scientist or brain surgeon or something, but he's really making a very apt point. The public justifiably says, why do I have to hire somebody? And by the way, I'm not talking about the kind of door openers who rely on their relationships. I'm talking about the expert advocates, like the lawyer lobbyists in my law firm. Mm-hmm. Why should I have to pay for somebody? It's my government, and why should I have to pay somebody to help me make my case? But think about it for a minute. Lawyers often say anybody who represents themselves in court has a fool for a lawyer and an idiot for a client. The public policy arena, the Congress and the agencies, is every bit as difficult to make your case, to understand what's going on. And so it just makes sense. There's a real need for experts. Because we have so many massive issues that have been pent up, that's why, notwithstanding sort of a spike up in the historic, you know, ever since the Garden of Eden, lobbyists have been in disfavor. But this is a particularly acute time when people are upset about everything that doesn't work in Washington.
Well, let me turn back to Tom Ferguson for a minute, because, Tom, I know you've studied and written about this extensively. Is there a connection between legislative favor and the amounts of money that are contributed to lawmakers through lobbying? I mean, I think that if you were to ask the American public, so many people are skeptical of lobbying and what's going on in Washington, and that lobbyists are exercising undue influence on public policy. I mean, is there a connection?
Yeah, you bet there's a connection. It's complicated. But let me just – the focus on campaign contributions is too narrow. I just talked about a study that showed you that when people leave their senator and set up as lobbyists, when that senator leaves, they lose 20% of their income and it stays down, doesn't come back. These are folks who've set themselves up as successful lobbyists. There's another great study by Alan Zebrovitz and his associates in, I think it's in the Journal of Financial and Quantitative Economics, one of the top journals in the field. Anyway, what they actually do is they work through, it took them 8 years to do it, and they had to meet a lot of objection. They had to meet a lot of trouble from the folks holding the data, from Congress. They walk through the portfolios of congressmen and women, that is to say, what they own in stocks. And they did a paper on U.S. senators. And what they show you is fantastic. It's that effectively, individuals, U.S. senators, make on average 1% more a month in their portfolios above market. Now, that means you're 12 percentage points above market at the end of the year, on a sort of annualized story. These are the highest rates of return ever recorded. Now, George Soros, Warren Buffett, they can't consistently do that. What Zebrovitz and his folks show you absolutely for sure is that these folks are you know, put bluntly, they're clearly working off inside information. They also show you it's not related to your committee assignments. It's not coming to you from that. Well, that's not a campaign contribution. That's cash you can take to the bank.
Nick Allard, help us understand the nuts and bolts of what you do as a lobbyist. When you have a client that calls you up and says, Nick, you know, I want to meet the Speaker of the House tomorrow, how do you navigate that? How do you go about doing business for your clients?
That's a great question. First of all, what we're basically not selling is information and access. That's everybody's right, and increasingly, especially with the Open Government Initiative, and because you can even watch hearings and markups online at your home computer, you know, the public has access, but it's interpreting and being able to read through those 1,800 bills and to understand and weigh and evaluate. So what we're primarily offering is analysis, advice, and expert advocacy. So then to respond directly to your specific question, my most reoccurring nightmare is when I get a call from a client, and assume it's a commercial client, not a pro bono client, we have many of them, and not a public interest client, but just say it's a corporate client, and the general counsel or the vice president for government affairs will say, our CEO is in town next Thursday, and she has a window in her schedule between 1:15 and 3:30. Would you set up a meeting with Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader, and maybe Congressman Markey and somebody else? And so my answer to them is, you can bang nails in with a violin, but it's a waste of violins. I can do it, but so can your secretary. What we would much rather do, and this is what we do, is we ask the question, why do you want to have the meeting? Here's six reasons why you shouldn't have the meeting.
But is every lobbyist like you? Does every lobbyist ask that question? And when does it turn ugly? And when do lobbyists cross the line, as the public perceives happens all the time?
Jane, here's the dirty little secret. Not all the good lobbyists are like that. The one who increasingly are in big demand because of the growing need for expert advocacy are operating not in selling access but in expertise, and doing that and helping to prepare and writing the briefing papers and analyzing the legislation, attending the meeting, doing the follow-up, meeting with staff and so on beforehand, and also convincing, you know, a client that what they're looking for is either not feasible or unnecessary or actually, you know, could expose them to some downsides. Now, one of the bright sides to the Abramoff fiasco, and by the way, he wasn't a lobbyist, he's a crook, and he got caught out in a perverse way. It's an example of the system working, because under existing laws he was caught, convicted, and served time. He was operating a political Ponzi scheme, not a public policy advocacy scheme of the worst kind. He was taking from the people that could probably least afford, some of the Native Americans, to pay, and he was, you know, working both sides of an issue, which is a no-no for anybody. But increasingly, people are, and clients are, much more sophisticated and savvy and suspicious of the quick fix, cutting corners, and doing things the wrong way. And so what you have is, with this great need, the need for lobbying doesn't go away, but the public is more sophisticated. There's a flight to quality, and they're more willing to hire folks who are credentialed or they can depend on will do things the right way.
Well,
you don't want to get into the New York Times or the Washington Post on the front page because you've hired somebody who's done something the wrong way.
Let me get some callers in here. Nick and Tom and Paul, many are lined up. Dave is on first from Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Dave. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I think the elephant in the room is corporatism.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken, the Constitution addressed individuals to redress.
All right. Dave, thank you. Paul Singer, why don't you respond to that? Dave thinks that the issue here is corporatism, that that lobbying is a big problem and that big corporations are to blame.
There's been a big discussion about this, about whether corporations count as individuals. Can a corporation speak under the First Amendment? And my understanding, and I'm not a legal expert, I suspect that Nick Allard has a better sense of this than I do, but my understanding is recent court cases have essentially said, yeah, corporations do count as individuals. They can speak. And until there is some clear ruling to the opposite, saying that no, corporations are not individuals and are not entitled to those rights, I think they're treated that way.
You know, Paul, it's Nick. The question offers a very provocative and great insight. And you hit it right on the head, is in terms of the logical extension of the Citizens United case the Supreme Court handed down, which is what you were talking about, and whether a corporation has the same rights as an individual in the political sphere. And, you know, maybe someday we'll be putting corporations up to run for office. I don't mean that. I'm being facetious. But what underlies that, and what I think that the caller was really asking in addition, was what about undue influence? In our political system, where we have this multitude of different voices competing, do the for-profit interests have undue influence? And when that issue arises, it's very interesting. There tends to be efforts to restrict lobbying. And I've said, and this is what I recently had in Newsweek, and of course after I said this, Newsweek announced it was going out of business, so maybe it was poison. But that actually that's just the wrong way to go. Because the well-off interests have many arrows in their quivers. They can communicate. You know, you see the folks from Wall Street, they have no problem picking up the phone and calling the Treasury Secretary, getting into the White House to get their points of view. Sometimes it's the little folks, the folks like the employees of the little folks, the Main Street people, the, you know, real Americans, if you will, who need the representation. It's critical to them. And so what we really need to do is, like in the legal system, you know, in the legal system, if you don't have means, there's methods in civil and criminal proceedings to find you with adequate, affordable representation. So rather than cutting down and trying to level the playing field, which increases the advantage the well-off have, we should be very creative in providing more lobbying muscle to the folks that are less advanced.
So, Tom Ferguson, jump in here. What about
to
the caller's
point? I have to tell you, I think
the
caller's query was right on point, which very simply, you know, we all know, or actually we don't all know, that's a problem, but when the 14th Amendment was passed, it was tweaked a bit by, at the time I think it was a bank attorney and some railroad attorneys, and then later reinterpreted about 20 years later by same to cover corporations. I mean, since those Supreme Court decisions in the late 19th century, there was the business of corporations as persons, which was the legal issue there, did get established. But nobody actually wanted to maintain that corporations had all the rights of all normal natural persons, at least until very recently. The notion that you could not restrict corporate cash, for example, was quite foreign. I mean, since it was the first national bill on that, covering only national political contributions, to about 1905, what the Supreme Court just did is in effect, you know, was as strict constructionists that they are, they overthrew a century of jurisprudence.
Let me get another call in here. Susan is waiting from Mount Sydney, Virginia. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. Just a quick observation on all levels, from Washington to Wall Street to the corporate world. We have become so intricate and complicated with so many levels. I don't believe we can regulate. And what it comes down to is people have to have a conscience. We all know what's right and wrong. And we can't regulate anybody to do the right thing. So unless we're going to have people honestly make the right decision, I can't see how regulation can ever fix the problems that we have right now.
Susan, thank you. Paul Singer, I'll turn to you on that one. We heard a lot of this on the campaign trail with President Obama before he became president, talking about reform of lobbyists in Washington. Has much changed? What about regulation of this issue?
Well, I got to tell you, the House Ethics Committee recently did a report on lobbying in a particular organization called the PMA Group. And essentially, they were looking into whether or not lobbyists were buying access and buying favors. And the very bizarre conclusion of this report was this, that there is a widespread perception amongst lobbyists and corporations that their campaign donations are buying access and legislative favors. However, the Ethics Committee of the House concluded, nobody involved in the House of Representatives is guilty of doing anything wrong or ultimately has any responsibility for any of that, so they closed the investigation.
Essentially exonerated themselves.
Exonerated everybody. Everybody.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the world of lobbying in Washington. I'm joined this hour by Paul Singer, associate editor and investigative reporter at Roll Call. Tom Ferguson is also with me. He's professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. And Nick Allard, partner and head of Patton Boggs, lobbying, political, and election law practice. Tom Ferguson, let me come back to you right out of the break here. You heard Nick Allard say that we need more lobbyists to give voice to the little guy. What about organizations like the American Cancer Society, environmental groups, so-called people-oriented lobbying, that lobby on behalf of the poor or the sick? Aren't there lobbies that do good?
Right. We can tell how wonderful the poor and the sick were doing in the recent health care debate, right? Now, that was another case where, for example, one evening there was a Senate committee vote that turned out quite favorable to the insurers. And the insurance stocks leaped up that afternoon again. Now, nobody would report this. I actually wrote a note to one of the New York Times correspondents and said, why don't you guys start talking about this? Because all you're doing is floating all this crap in public about how this is socialism, et cetera, when in fact what's going on here is you're protecting a single industry. And people knew it wasn't socialism. If it were socialism, corporate stocks would have been tanking like crazy. That came right in the middle of a sort of big revival in the stock market. It was going up, not down. I don't think anybody thinks that the health care bill worked out particularly well for poor folks, except on the very narrow issue of coverage itself. In general, they did nothing in there to sort of force price to do any kind of serious cost controls.
And to blame.
And lobbying was certainly a crucial part of it, along with political cash, tips to congressmen, and the general general surrounding of the political unit. I mean, virtually anything quoted in the press on that stuff came from some think tank. Somebody had to put cash into it. Or just look at financial reform.
Well,
they
let's
are
get to
gutting that in what has been a series of bad bills are now becoming increasingly enfeebled. It might expire before our program is over.
So on June 7th, play a special live recording of On Point at the State House in Boston, where Tom Ashbrook spoke to Elizabeth Warren, professor at Harvard Law School and chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel, created to investigate the U.S. banking bailout. Tom asked her if we are on track for effective financial reform.
I think we're in a place where that could happen, but not a place where it's guaranteed to happen.
If it's not guaranteed at this point, they're going into conference committee. They've got the raw material. They're not going to get – are they going to get new brainwaves in there?
No, but what they are going to get are even more lobbyists.
You're not giving us comfort yet.
No, because there shouldn't be any comfort. Because as soon as you think there's comfort and we all say, ah, this is great, let's all lean back just a little bit, believe me, somebody who is making a whole lot of money is going to slip into that gap, and they're going to get one line changed, and they're going to get one little provision dropped, and they're going to get one more piece compromised out. And at the end of the day, we can all congratulate ourselves that we got something that has the right title and has no real impact.
So Nick Allard, Tom Ferguson is skeptical. Elizabeth Warren is as well. I mean, will financial reform be effective, or will it be something where we congratulate ourselves on the back, but really this has no teeth?
Well, Tom's skeptical and cynical, so that's quite a combo. And I really take issue with him on the health care reform. I would not minimize at all the importance of getting coverage to all those millions of Americans who didn't have it. And, you know, it took so long, and there was compromise, that dirty old word, but because, you know, everybody can't get everything they want. And the reason it was so difficult, my former boss, Ted Kennedy, you know, made it his life's work and didn't even see it, managed to see it despite his end to its conclusion, is that this is a varied, heterogeneous country with lots of different interests, geographic regions, and so on. You know, almost every American agreed in principle that we should have better health care coverage to folks. But then the question is, well, who's going to pay for it? Am I going to pay for it? Can I afford it? And also, I want to hear more detail about what the health care reform means for me. I'm not thrilled with my current health care, but I sure as heck don't want it to be any worse. So these are legitimate questions that people were wrestling with. Now, on financial reg reform, that is even more, that's more like three-dimensional chess. The biggest lobbyists on financial services reform. I meant financial services reform, which was your question, are other countries. That's why, you know, maybe the most significant thing that's happened is to move the emphasis from the G7 to the G20, and that lawmakers in different countries realize that our financial markets are increasingly global, and it doesn't work at all. It doesn't work at all for one country to set up a regime of regulation unilaterally because capital just flows. So suppose the United States tightens up, but Europe or UK or Japan doesn't, and you know what the result is.
But
so.
Back to the point of lobbying, I mean, I'm looking
well,
at a study.
Could we pick up on the point here? I mean, Europe is virtually every European country is now proposing at the upcoming G20 to do, for instance, a bank tax. That's opposed by the U.S. They're going to do it without the U.S. And look what's and guess what's going to happen? The European financial markets will not fall apart any more than when the German government banned credit default swaps on sovereign debt. You know, the world you thought the world was falling apart in the U.S. press.
Tom Singer, let me ask you about financial reform. I'm looking at this study from the Public Citizen and Center for Responsive Politics here that says for every sitting member of Congress, there are three former colleagues or government staffers lobbying for banks during this financial reform conversation. How do you see this playing out?
Right. Well, I mean, these are exceptionally complicated pieces of legislation, healthcare and financial reform, covering essentially the entire U.S. economy at some level. And there are going to be winners and losers. You can't ask me this question of, well, is this going to be a good bill? Is it going to do something good? I can guarantee you it's going to do something good for somebody. I don't know how many somebodies, and I don't know who is going to find something bad in the back end of the bill as well, or who will be affected poorly. I mean, none of these are simple black and white answers of, yes, the bill is good, yes, the bill is bad. And one of the things that's interesting about that financial reform bill is there was a nice story in the Washington Post this morning about Russell Simmons, who's the founder of Def Jam Records. He's a lobbyist in this bill because his company also produces debit cards, prepaid debit cards for their customers, and they're trying to get themselves, looks like they're going to succeed and get themselves exempted from the regulation on fees that would apply to other major financial institutions. Is that a win or a loss? I don't know. It's probably a win for Russell Simmons, and he would argue it's a win for his customers. I just don't know.
Nick Allard, let me turn back to you. I know you have to run here at the end of the hour, but what do you see on the horizon in Washington, D.C. as it relates to lobbying and lobbyists? You're head of the biggest lobbying and political practice wing in the city, I mean, in the district. What do you see?
Well, at least two things. One is, and I'm on the ABA task force to look at how to better regulate lobbying. You're going to have better and better regulated lobbying. We need some rules. We need better rules on earmarks, for example. I mean, that's an area where I'm sure I can agree, you know, with Tom, Professor Ferguson, and many others that, you know, we need more transparency. It's a wonderful disinfectant. I'd be the head of the line folks that would prohibit making campaign contributions to members in a Congress when they're considering an earmark for the person that's making the contribution. I mean, you need to cut that tie, even if there isn't a quid pro quo. There's too much of an appearance. But then also is our system is changing, and the way that lobbyists and people and the public and the grassroots is rapidly changing, and we need to look at the problems and the challenges around the corner, not yesterday's headlines, not, you know, how to go after the Jack Abramoffs of the world, you know, or these other problems about, you know, the way money was raised. So, for example, there's so much now reliance on electronic interaction that the old image of the single phone call or the face-to-face meeting is less and less dominant, and you need to be, you know, techno-savvy, and the government solicits and gives out information. And also, you know, the Congress and the White House have a real challenge ahead because they're sort of conveying to the public that they're going to run the government like American Idol. You know, text us what you want us to do. And this is the age-old issue ever since Sir Edmund Burke spoke about it in 1774 to the electors of Bristol. You know, what's the role of leadership? When are you a representative, not a mere delegate? And a lot of these questions, as Paul Singer was suggesting, a lot of these issues don't lend themselves to a simple up or down vote. So we need to be looking at those things. And if I can have one more minute, maybe one of the most important things for the government to get a hold of and for others to get a hold of, and I really believe this passionately, is if increasingly your keys to economic prosperity and your access to participatory democracy, interacting with the government, is depending on your access and knowledge to use affordable broadband technology, what do we do what do we do as a country about the people that don't have it? And there's a large number of people don't have it, don't know how to use it. And we can't abandon them and leave them behind. And so these are the issues I'm suggesting that increasingly we're going to be looking at as some of these other issues sink into the La Brea pits. And so that's just my little hobby horse.
Nick Allard, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. Thanks so much. Anytime. And
thank you.
Unfortunately, I'm going to run off.
Thank you very much. Nick Allard is head of Patton Boggs Lobbying, Washington's largest lobbying firm. Let's go back to the phones. Gloria is calling from Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Gloria. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I would just like to ask your speaker to speak about John Ashcroft and where he went. And the perfect example of political compromise in Washington is John Breaux and Trent Lott and Grover Norquist, who funneled money for Jack Abramoff, has a brother in the Treasury Department. That's
so,
all I have to say.
Okay. I think this notion of parties coming together, opposite political parties forming lobbying groups when they leave office. Tom Ferguson, is that a possibility? Is there room for political compromise in lobbying?
I am reminded of Bob Hope's comment. I think that was the best ever, where he just, you know, you can fool some of the people all the time, all the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. That's why we have a two-party system.
What do you say to Nick Allard's comments about reform and regulation?
We're not running the government like American Idol. We're running it like Sotheby's to the highest auction. It's an auction house. I mean, that's essentially what's going on here.
So you agree with Jack Abramoff, who says that this is legalized bribery, this system?
Yeah, I would. Yes, basically. We would add that, you know, again, it's not just campaign finance here. And we have serious problems with, in effect, part of the big story here, when you step back and look at all, just from all this stuff and focus, effectively, you've massively increased economic inequality in American life over the last 40 or 50 years. And you went from CEO to ordinary worker salaries of about 25 to 1 in the 1960s to it got to about 625 to 1 in like 2005. Then it sunk, I think, recently down to about 353 to 1, something like that. I mean, that economic inequality is now just translating directly into political inequality. It's just a Latin Americanization of the United States. It might as well be Mexico or Brazil.
What are your ideas for remedies?
Well,
what do you want to see
you
happen?
Start first. You can see, first of all, you have a big problem with the current Supreme Court, which just actually issued an order, not well explained, voiding payments to the public financing system in Arizona. But basically, you're going to have to take big money out of politics. Now, you can do this without taking anybody's rights to free speech away. You need public financing. Then you're going to have to professionalize regulation. You know, it's not true that you can't regulate. You know, Elizabeth Warren could regulate consumer bank loans without any trouble at all. The problem is that Elizabeth Warren can't get near the position to actually do that. I mean, her mere appearance on that TARP oversight committee led to a near political revolution inside the Democratic Party, where the Democratic member of that committee was threatening to vote with the Republicans to block them from certain inquiries.
Let me get another call in here quickly. David is on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, David. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, some excellent points. I worked as a lobbyist for a couple of years, and I can say absolutely our elected officials need expertise. We don't elect experts in every category that they're going to be making laws about, so they need the expertise. The question is really, who is going to pay for it? Is it going to be corporations paying for expertise coming in, or is it going to be taxpayers paying for elected officials to hire on experts to help them write this legislation?
David, thank you. I appreciate your point. Let's go to another one. Neil is in Clarksville, Tennessee. Hi, Neil. Thank you for waiting. Welcome.
Hello. My question is, what effect does your guest think compulsory voting would have on limiting the power of lobbyists? And in any major decision, such as health care reform, where it could be put to a referendum, say, if a certain number of senators propose propose that it be put to a referendum.
Got it, Neil. Thank you. Tom Ferguson?
You know, the short answer to that is a system that ran voter turnout up to near 100% would certainly change the way laws get written. I mean, Australia has a system of compulsory voting. I mean, some countries do it. The American system is famously a low turnout system. I mean, Walter Dean Burnham and I have written a lot on that stuff. And you can see absolutely just how sort of devastating has been the low turnout, persistently low turnout American elections. You know, I am quite struck, for instance, by the way the Obama administration has not done much on electoral reform, incidentally. It's done almost nothing. It's been in office 2 years. And we all knew there were serious problems with that.
About 30 seconds left, Tom Ferguson. Anything changing on the horizon from your perspective? I asked Nick Allard the same thing as far as this burgeoning industry of lobbying in Washington.
I think it's probably only going to get worse. You can be sure the financial reform bill won't fundamentally affect any of the considerations that caused the world to collapse, you know, on September 15, 2008, when Lehman went down. I'm afraid if you want a happy ending, see a Disney movie.
Paul Singer, how do you see it? You get the final word here.
Well, the thing that I see at the moment is disclosure is improving, which is good. The primary problem at the moment is the disclosure of a lot of the stuff, what members of Congress own, how they spend their own money, how they spend the money in their offices. The disclosure is terrible. It's very hard for a regular citizen to get in there and realize, oh, hey, my member of Congress owns some of that stock. They don't disclose what lobbyists they meet with and when they do. I believe some of that is moving in the direction of more disclosure and more visibility, which at least should give the public some confidence that they can see what their member is doing and maybe make better judgments that way.
Well, thank you very much for an interesting hour. Paul Singer joining me from Washington, associate editor and investigative reporter at Roll Call. Paul, thank you very much.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
And Tom Ferguson joining me in the studio, political science professor at the University of Massachusetts Boston, also senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. Tom, thank you very much.
Thanks.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.